All right. So when Una asked me to give a talk, she also asked me to review the MIPS observations that were done prior to the work that we did. So my group in particular, the PI on this in this project was Larry Rudnick at Minnesota, but it includes a whole group of people. And Jessica Ennis is also here, and she has a poster up. And if you haven't seen it by today, well, too bad, it's going to be gone by lunch, right? So what I'm going to talk about today is the results from Spitzer, including the MIPS, and then the observations that we did. This picture was taken off of Jessica's poster, and I'll talk about that a little bit later as I go on. I'm not going to actually give any conclusions or take you on any sort of linear path through these observations of CASA. What I'm going to do is try to have a series of small 1, 2, or 3 slide talks that are self-contained. And that way, if I don't get all the way down to here, that's fine. I'm not going to rush you through the last 16 slides in 2 minutes. If you feel that you really need to learn about the spectral index and we didn't get there, by all means, ask about that during the question period afterwards. Going along here, the first few things I'm going to talk about are the 24 micron MIPS image and the light echoes. I have a little bit more to say on that than that they exist. Then I'll go and run down through our observations, and this is in the order of things that I think are cool. I will try to keep each of these self-contained and try to explain sort of each one in its own little shell. Starting off with the MIPS observations, earlier in the conference, I think it was Monday, somebody had asked about the structure around CASA. So this is a 24 micron MIPS observation. By the way, this is public. All the MIPS observations that have been taken, there are 3 now, this was the latest, are all public. I am not an et al. On this. I'm not in that Krauss at all or the Hines at all. I have absolutely nothing to do with these images whatsoever. But here they are, and I've burned this way out. CASA is the bright thing in the middle, and all of this is the structure around it. Most of this is not related to CASA. Most of this stuff is random interstellar cirrus clouds. We can zoom in on CASA and not burn it out quite so much, and we see that CASA at 24 microns, and this is mostly dust emission. It also contains, at the far end of the band, near 26 microns, iron 2 and oxygen 4, so there's some line emission in here as well. And this image looks very much like the optical image. Oh, by the way, I don't know if you guys can see it very well. Everybody always points to these sorts of images that, you know, and you know, burning out the megasecond and look at the 24 micron image here. Look, a counter jet, and I even put an exclamation point. But you know, this was seen in the optical a long, long time ago. Rob, when was the first time that an optical image was published showing the chemistry over here and that it was the same as the chemistry over here? But anyhow. So now that we've looked at CASA close up, I'm going to take you out a little bit more. This is from the Krauss et al. Observation showing the structures to the north and south of CASA. And so this particular observation doesn't include material to the left and right like I showed previously. So they noted this material out here. And a year later, they took another image, and this is the difference image between 2 images that were taken a year apart. The images show a great deal of structural change, and so, for instance, you can see this knot here that was missing in the second epoch, and this is why it's black here in the difference image. It went away. You can see something down here that was missing on the first image that was taken, and yet it was there on the second. And also notice that in these blobs, a great deal of structural change that almost looks like radial motion. And if you analyze these, in principle, you would see structures that are moving at nearly the speed of light. To confirm this, the author and his collaborators made some ground-based observations. And so these images here are, what are these, 7 months apart? And so they show motion, again, consistent with velocities on the order of c. So these sort of basically confirm these. By the way, this was taken up here in this northern lobe. So it's not just some random spot. They actually tried to choose an observation that was near where they saw structural changes. Their interpretation of what's going on here is that we're seeing light echoes, but not just simply a reflection. What they think we're seeing is the heating of the dust and then a re-emission or a re-radiation. Because this material looks like it's sort of several light fronts propagating through the material, their explanation, or the author's explanation, is that we have sort of, or sometime in the past, there were some short duration bursts, possibly associated with the central compact object, and possibly beamed. And so their particular cartoon in this case is that this structure and this structure are in the plane of the sky at the same distance as Cass A, and that the light circle or sphere intersects these at these are a tangent point on that light sphere. And so that would put, if these guys are truly in the plane of the sky or very nearly in the plane of the sky, that would put a major outburst at approximately 1953. 50 years ago or so. So that's their argument for what's going on. One of the reasons why they're arguing that it's not just a reflection, that it's actually a re-emission, is because the spectra of these regions don't show line emission. I mean, at least not above standard interstellar amounts. And so it's not just a reflection of the light from, you know, from the for instance, the ejector or anything like that. Also, they went and looked at here in the radio. They put a pointing up there. They found no radio emission from up here. They went to the 1999 Chandra observation with HRC, and they find no emission that would correspond to any of these things out here to indicate that there's any sort of X-ray excitation. Nothing jumped out at them. And so that's why they're sort of arguing that it's essentially a dust emission process, that the dust is being heated and then it re-radiates. They're arguing that whatever this thing is at the center, they're arguing that because of the episodic or apparently episodic outbursts in the past, that it might be a soft gamma ray repeater, and that it's currently quiescent. And so that's why we haven't seen anything happen exciting recently. But my understanding of what's going on here is that there's something funny. And I'll start by looking up to here. These guys were taken in this lobe over here, and yet their arrows point that way. And if they're here, that way does not point back to Cass A. So that's the first thing that bothers me. There are other things that bother me. This filament down here basically moves as one structure, or appears to move as one structure. How exactly is a light echo going to make this filament appear as though the whole thing moves? And by the way, I've done the blinking. It's not that it's a motion down and to the left. The motion is almost straight down if you blink these guys back and forth. You get the sense that it's a motion that's straight down. But still, you'd need like a sheet, a nice, planar, somewhat homogeneous sheet of material in order for this echo to propagate down it and not change significantly. So that's the second thing that bothered me. But there's more. So this is the MIPS observation from 30 November 2003. This is the observation a year later, 2 December 2004. And this is the last observation a couple months later, 3 February 2005. This blob that I'm pointing at here moves towards Cass A. Okay, great, you might argue that there's such a large time scale here, the light crossing time and all, it could be a completely different blob. But from here to here, the blob moves inward, and it's the same blob. Unless somebody wants to challenge me, okay, I'll give that up. But I think it's the same blob, and moving inward is bad. So that bothers me. Now, let me go back here, let me show you where I'm going to head next. Let's go back up over to here. And what I'm outlining, again, the same three epochs. I'm outlining this little front here. It's not moving inwards. This is an improvement. But its direction of motion is that way. I've put that line there to suggest that the direction of motion is perpendicular to that line. And Cass A is straight down. And so, it's not moving radially away from Cass A, as my simple cartoon would predict. Maybe it's my ignorance level here, but that's what my simple cartoon would predict. And so, reading the Krauss paper and asking, what about these non-radial motions? And Krauss says, by the way, there are non-radial motions. And says, nothing more. And so, that bothered me. I tried to ignore the elephant, but it didn't go away. So my conclusion here is that I don't know. Maybe it's my ignorance level where I don't understand quite how these light echoes can propagate in a non-radial fashion away from Cass A. And in some cases, when you have these long filaments that are, you know, non-tangential to Cass A, I'm not certain how that works. You can draw your own conclusions. I will make another. I found a way to include radio images in this talk. This is a 16-year evolution of Cass A from 1978 to 1994. I think this is the only movie during the week that is of a real object, not a simulation. So what I want to point out is this little knot down here. You'll notice this little knot is pretty much standing still. Not moving outward with the rest of the remnant. It's standing still. Krauss et al. Make the argument that since this little knot appeared between 1969 and 1974, that it may be related to, and the point source, if it were here, would be up here, just a little bit to the left of the bright emission here at the center, somewhere around there. They make the argument that this knot appeared approximately the right time frame, if it were moving at 0.6C, to have been ejected from the point source in 1953. And that SGRs show evidence of outburst of relativistic particles. However, this knot is not moving at all. Not moving. So, in this cartoon, this knot would have had to have come down here, made its way through the reverse shock area, unscathed, come out to the forward shock, and suddenly be stopped, having traveled at 0.6C. Now, ejecta are able to make it through the forward shock at 7,000 kilometers per second. But this guy suddenly hits a brick wall. Okay, so that's another thing that bothers me. The last thing, and then I'll stop, is that where is the opposite? Where is the bright knot up here that would have been the ejection on the other side headed north towards that way? So that's where I'll stop with my rants sort of on, yeah. That's what I would call it. And I think Krauss et al. Would call it a QSF bullet. That's a joke. So So that's where I'm going to stop. You guys can draw your own conclusions. Maybe there's an ignorance level here that I'm missing. Okay, so having used up a good portion of the talk, now let's go on to our observations. So we lit up CASE with everything that was left since the MIPS was taken. We used all four IRAC observations with about 1.2 arcsecond per pixel spatial resolution. These are broadband observations. All of these images, 3.6, 4.5, 5.7, and 8 microns, are on Jessica's poster. We then did, in a mammoth observing operation, spectral mapping over nearly the entire extent of CASE. This is low resolution spectra between about approximately 5 and 40 microns. The spatial resolution varies from about 2 arcseconds at short low to about 6 arcseconds for the long low. The short low required over 1,200 pointings. This is the largest spectral mapping with Spitzer to date. And the man who did this for us was J.D. Smith. I get down on my knees every day and thank God for J.D. Smith. J.D. Smith developed the Cubism program, which takes all of these 1,200 pointings. Well, actually, technically, it's 1,200 for one order, and then we have the other order, and then we have the long lows, and turns them into useful spectral cubes, which is great. We then went out and took several spectra of some outlying blobs that had been identified through MIPS, hoping that if we found some ejecta out there, some line emission in those blobs, that it would be useful. I'm not going to talk about any of these blobs today. For the most part, when we looked way out there, we saw nothing but dust, which is depressing. The global spectrum of CASE has lots of fun lines. We've got argon 2, argon 3, we've got neon lines. We even have neon 5, although it's at the edge of one of our orders, and so it can red or blue shift. But anyhow, we have sulfur 3, and we actually have two lines of sulfur 3. They're a wonderful density indicator. We have silicon 2, and then we have the mess here at 26 microns, which is blended iron 2 and oxygen 4. We know that we have some iron 2. We know we have some oxygen 4. We're not certain exactly how to separate that, depending on where we're at in the remnant. So now let me go on to one of my favorite things in the remnant. We're calling this once-shocked ejecta. If you talk to anybody outside of our group, the term would be unshocked ejecta. But we're calling it once-shocked for a reason. We're calling it once-shocked because sometime when the star blew up, the initial blast wave went through everything and shocked it. Then we had wonderful adiabatic expansion, everything cooled, dust formed, it's cold, and we don't see it again until it hits the reverse shock. What we actually have, though, is emission from this material at the center. And this material is bright in silicon 2, sulfur 3, sulfur 4, and iron 2. We have a little bit more down here. It's all of this diffuse stuff to the center. The knotty stuff around the edge, which looks a lot like the optical emission, that's ejecta in lines of argon and neon. So the silicon and sulfur at the center here, diffuse, unshocked or once shocked ejecta, and around the edge are lines of neon and argon, the ejecta that we all know and love. Talking about this once-shocked ejecta component, there's no associated dust with this, which makes me think it's cold, because if it had been, I don't know, shock-heated, we should see dust. Dust should be sputtering away like crazy, but we do not see an associated dust component with this. The cartoon about why we see this emission in the first place is that it's photoionized by X-ray and UV emission from the twice-shocked ejecta. And so I'm going to actually throw those terms out. If I use unshocked and shocked, that's what I mean. And so that's the cartoon. I don't know how strong this cartoon is. I'm not an ionization kind of person. I'm not certain exactly how the physics work here, but that's the cartoon. The two sulfur 3 lines that we have, we can use as a density indicator, and someday we will actually use that as a density indicator. The measurement will be made. An interesting thing is that the lines that we see, the silicon and the sulfur lines that we see, which we learned at the AAS, Steve Reynolds had a poster, he sees these same lines in the PWN around pulsar 0540. And so the cartoon popped into my mind, could we possibly have a hidden PWN here? Background for those of you who don't study CASA, there is no PWM detected in the x-rays or in the radio. None whatsoever. That's a big, big, you know, hint that there's probably not a PWN and that this is just fodder. But I'm throwing it out there because, my God, the point source is like right there. Something's going on. So maybe there's a PWN in here. We don't need it to be shocking this material. It can simply be compressing it a little bit. It doesn't take much to excite silicon 2, for instance. It doesn't take much at all. Silicon 2 is found almost everywhere in the universe, along with iron 2. So it doesn't take much to get them excited. However, given that there's no radio or x-ray evidence, we can quickly move on to the next idea. Suppose that the central brightening is due to some sort of a Stromgren sphere effect around the point source. But again, I'm just throwing that out there. Calculations could easily be done to confirm or deny that, but I'm just throwing it out there. We haven't done any tests on that just yet. Because it's line emission, we have Doppler shifts. So in the middle here, oh, by the way, so Doppler shifts here, this structure is almost exactly the type of structure that you find in the optical. Lorentz et al. It's been done. There's nothing new to be seen here in the blue or the red or what's going on down here or out here. The Doppler velocities, about 6,000 to minus 3,000. The velocities are consistent. The locations are consistent. There's nothing new. But let's look at the fuzzy stuff in the middle. This fuzzy stuff in the middle has red and blue shifted emission. I had this crazy idea, I think last week, that perhaps these could be jets of emission from the center. But I've changed my mind on that. I've been taking some cuts through this material and looking at the Doppler shifts, you know, in wavelength versus declination, that sort of thing. And my best guess right now is that we have a cavity or a shell. So here is the silicon 2 line taking a cut through the center. And you can see that we actually have the two line profile for a red and a blue shifted. This red and blue shift is approximately plus to minus 3,000. So this stuff isn't necessarily a ball at the center. It's basically a shell. I can see a front and a back side. And it's going to take a lot more playing around with the data to actually figure out what the geometry of this thing is and what the kinematics are. But it will be done someday. And so, yeah, this is just way cool. The idea here is that if this really is unshocked ejecta, and if we don't have something disrupting the dynamics at the center, you know, a PWN that could really screw things up, we could be looking at the dynamics of the explosion completely unmolested. Completely unmolested by the CSM interaction. This stuff hasn't hit the reverse shock. It doesn't know what's going on at the reverse shock. Whatever asymmetries we see here were caused by the explosion. Or could be caused by the explosion if you agree with our interpretation. So that's just way cool. Five? Okay. When we go to questions, I'm hoping Rob Thiessen will comment on this. And I've stolen several pictures of his. So this one here on the right was from his talk earlier in the week. We think we see, at several parsecs out, a shell that may have come from the progenitor wind. This is way cool. So let me build this up for you. So let's look over here on the left-hand side. This picture here is a picture in H alpha plus nitrogen 2. All of these little dense clumps you see here, these are the quasi-stationary flocculi, the dense clumps from the CSM wind, or the progenitor wind. This fluffy stuff over here, which, you know, would remind you of an H alpha cloud, is also enhanced in nitrogen 2. And I'm going to put words in Rob's mouth. It's his opinion that this stuff is wind from the star because of the nitrogen 2 enhancement. It's also this stuff right here, this fuzzy stuff, that's the same stuff that's up here. This is where all of these outer ejecta knots are being lit up as they're interacting with this fluffy cloud. And it's right at the edge of the remnant, right at the edge of the forward shock out there. So we think that this really is related to the remnant, and that it really is a piece of its wind. And so, right here, the right-hand side, is that H-alpha nitrogen 2 cloud with suggestively shaped contours from silicon 2. And so we've blown this up right here so that you can see sort of how well this silicon 2 matches with this structure of this cloud. So now we've burned out Cas A and silicon 2, and you can see that this silicon 2 extends all the way out here and all the way out here. That is way cool. That is just so neat. Now, you might ask, how do we know that this silicon 2 is really related to Cas A? There are several things that we've done here. Number one, in the making of the cube, J.D. Smith actually subtracted off a background so that he's getting rid of silicon 2 that just happens to occur everywhere in the universe. He subtracted that off. The second thing that was going on here is that when I made this particular image, integrating through the silicon 2 line, I'm adding up all my redshifts, I did a continuum subtraction. So I got rid of dust, I got rid of any extra PAHs, got rid of all that. So this is just the silicon 2 line emission above background and above continuum. There's more. We see it in sulfur 3, and although we don't have spectral mapping all the way out here in neon 2, because it's the order actually extended on the other side of Cas A, we get this piece out here in neon 3. And there are hints of it at neon 2. We don't expect neon 2 and neon 3 to occur everywhere in the universe the same way that silicon 2 does. This neon 2 and the neon 3 that we see in here really means that it has to be from Cas A. Or at least that's our interpretation today. The cool thing is that we've done a little bit of work here, and we can actually see variations in these lines. So we might actually be able to map out temperatures or densities, those sorts of things, to actually probe what the conditions are out at whatever this thing is. And if this thing does not match any of the structures that are seen in that 24 micron image. It's completely different stuff than what's seen at 24 microns. So that's like way cool. How am I doing? Finish up if I can? Let's see here. Oh, this is really cool. So this is, a neon 2 emission in the remnant. This is integrated over all of our Doppler shifts. So this is a moment zero map. Neon 2, pretty much everywhere where you see optical emission. But there's more. Right here, there's a hole in the X-ray emission. You guys, in fact, just saw Jessica's maps. She went right down here in the Silicon Valley. And yet, right next to the Silicon Valley, there was a hole. That's a megasecond. And yet, there's still a hole. In the optical, the only thing that's bright in the optical is right there at that spot right there. And I think that's a little bit of oxygen. Rob might have a different opinion. I think that's a little bit of oxygen right there. We see oxygen and neon right here. We also see right up here where that neon is bright, we see oxygen up there as well. Now that works because, well, I mean, if I had the optical image here, in optical and in x-rays, this is an oxygen knot. It's got extra oxygen. When we do our comparisons with our IRAC three-color mapping, we see that these areas stand out. They're neon-rich, or one might argue, they're everything else not rich. Everything else is missing. So we have what appear to be these two structures, north and south, that have different chemistry from the rest of the remnant. And to take that a step further, stealing another image from Rob, Rob has gaps north and south of the remnant. We have chemistry difference north and south of the remnant. Our cartoon is that perhaps there was a neon-rich ejection at 90 degrees to the jet axis, but along the position angle, so these two stars represent the offset between the optical expansion center and the current position of the point source. We have an inferred proper motion along this line, and this line is that axis between those neon-rich areas. In Doppler shift space, the neon-rich is over here on this side. That's the blue shifted side, and it's down here on this side, so it's approximately bipolar about the center as well. Of course, anytime you draw a line from one side to the other, but play with me on this one. So it's approximately bipolar there as well. So it could be either that we have sort of extra neon emission going out here, or it could be that we have a lack of the other stuff. And it's the lack of the other stuff that accounts for the gaps in Rob's outer knots. So I'm going to stop there. Thank you.
Let's give people a chance to ask questions.
Regarding the that diffuse emission you're seeing near the center that you attribute possibly to photoionized unshocked or singly shocked ejecta, there was a paper published a few years ago that I know you're aware of, the really low radio frequency observations by Kasim et al.
Yeah.
And I saw that spectral index flattening in the middle, and he attributed that to unshocked ejecta. Is there a way maybe you could compute how much mass there is there and whether that could produce the flattening that you see in the radio?
Yes. We actually have the follow-up observations for that as well at 74 megahertz. In principle, you can use the 74 megahertz absorption and calculate a tau based on your spectral index difference. And so you can then get a density and go towards a mass. And Namir did that in his paper, and he got an impressively large, 18 or 19 solar masses of unshocked ejecta. And that was painfully large. And then they acknowledged in the last paragraph, this is painfully large and it needs to be redone better. So one of our goals is to actually get some density measurements out of here, and then also go back and get some density measurements out of our newer observations at 74 megahertz and try to determine, sort of link the two, figure out where that 18 solar masses is causing the problems, and you'll get a real estimate on the mass.
I have a comment and a question. The comment is, toward the south where you see the neon and oxygen go together.
Yes.
Over the last five to ten years, there's been a brightening in the optical along the southern rim, and it has now extended over to the east a little bit, just where you see the neon. And in fact, right there's a lot of oxygen knots, very strong oxygen knots. So it makes sense that there's neon there also. But I would caution you to make associations between one side of the rim and the other. By just saying that there's oxygen. There's also oxygen at the base of the jet. There's oxygen filaments of various other places. So just seeing a few oxygen knots to the north and a few to the south, and this likewise to the neon to the north and neon to the south, is not really strong evidence that there's some sort of bipolar symmetry there.
We're flying blind on that one.
Okay. The question I have is on the diffuse stuff that you see on the outside that's associated with that H2 or cloud, that diffuse cloud. You see it in silicon too, right?
Yes.
And you see it in a few other lines.
Yes.
And you said that that shows that it's associated with Cas A. Why would you say that?
Well, the silicon II is shaky because, granted, there's silicon II elsewhere in the ISM that has nothing to do with Cas A, but the neon 3 that we see there and the possible neon 2 is what I think is what ties it to Cas A. We haven't thought that far into it, but yeah, that's the thing is what gets it up to the neon 3. And so that's why we thought it must be associated with Cas A. But yeah, if there's a different source or, you know, we could be completely wrong about this.
Could you mention the curved spectra and the modified shocks?
All right. Let's go find some curved spectra. Ah, here we are. So the Channel 1 3.6 micron map in Iraq, it's actually almost identical to a ground-based K-band infrared images, and it's a good substitute for the radio. I did a quick spectral index to try to see how the spectral indices between Channel 1 and the radio match up to the radio observations that we all know and love, and I'm finding that most of the regions in the remnant where I can trust the measurement, where I'm away from stars, and you can see this sort of green stuff up here, where I'm away from contamination by line emission, I get a flattening of the spectrum. So this is radio spectral index, and I get a flattening by 0.05 to 0.1. To give you an idea, the spectral index range in Cas A between 6 centimeters and 20 centimeters is from like minus 0.9 to minus 0.6. So when I make this measurement out here, I get a range from like minus 0.8 to minus 0.6. So the steep things are flattening more than the flat things. But that's just a first order measurement. I haven't accounted for however much extinction that we have at 3.6 microns. The extinction should fall off rapidly, so it's not a critical. And when we tried to do this at 2 microns with the ground base, the extinction was just a bear. But it shouldn't be much of a correction for this. The other thing is the background subtraction. I just did a quick and dirty background subtraction. That's something else to take into account. But in either case, the extinction or the background subtraction will only increase the degree of flattening. And so I think this is really cool, because then we can actually put some data points on here, the radio and into the infrared, and then we can go around to the X-ray and track that.
Tracy, this is slightly off the topic, but a couple of years ago maybe, there was Kuba observations of Cas A, and they estimated that they had like 1 to 2 solar masses of dust in Cas A, which a lot of people have said is really excessive. Can you, from the Spitzer observations, comment on how much dust there is in Cas A at all?
I don't have a number for how much. Jessica, do you? Do you have, what are John Hughes' numbers? Oh, okay.
But do you think there's 2 dust temperatures, so the dust is between
the
dust.
But do you think there's any question that it could be anywhere up to like a solar mass or so? Some other papers came out after that which said it was 10 to the minus 4, and everything that Scuba was seeing was in the foreground. So that's a big range, and I was just wondering. Okay.
I was thinking that the location of your neon might actually be consistent with a bipolar or an asymmetric explosion, because if there is a lack of neon in general, that could be because of reprocessing, because when the star explodes, there is a lot of neon. But if you burn it off to silicon and sulfur, you would see it in the direction where the explosion is going. And if you find it actually opposite to that. So that may be neon from the progenitor that has not been burned all the way up to silicon and sulfur. So I think this sort of is consistent with the picture from bipolar explosion.
See, that's sort of why we jumped on it, because we know that there are these models out there that predict, you know, ejecta going off in different directions. I don't know that we have the evidence to support it. Like Rob said, you really have to be careful about this sort of thing. And there's neon everywhere. It just happens to be neon rich in those two spots.
Yeah,
so. So I'm arguing against our position.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just wanted to ask about the light echoes, and I think they must be light echoes of some kind, but do you know whether they occur in regions other than that kind of linear feature that appeared in the first set of observations? So people look more widely for light echo effects and seen anything, or has that been investigated?
So Krauss et al. Really wanted to refer only to those lobes north and south, because that's where they thought they saw the best evidence for radial expansion. And I'll give them that. I played with that a lot. It's relatively well behaved. If you go around the remnant to other spots that aren't in those lobes, it seems more chaotic. But still, we're limited to that narrow band that they did the first two pointings of MIPS in. That big pointing of MIPS, and this stands for big. That big pointing of MIPS hasn't been repeated to my knowledge, or if it has, it's not publicly available. So we don't have any information about the rest of that area.
Okay. Last question from Jack.
I'm taking it that you're very skeptical of that interpretation. Do you have an alternative?
No. See, that's the deal. There's clearly something going on. And it might be just that I'm not thinking about how the clumpy CSM and how this propagation of a shock front or a light echo front would appear in this, you know, you'd think, having mapped out the proper motions in Cas A, I'd have but I don't have a picture in my mind of how this propagation through a clumpy medium or how a filament can just sort of move. That bothers me. But I don't have an alternative, so. Do you have an alternative?
I was on the Krauss paper, so I think it's pretty cool.
About the soft gamma ray repeater explosion. Actually, if you look at the SDR 1806 burst, the spike had a very high temperature, something like 500 kV. So actually, most of the energy, the dust is transparent to that. It just goes right through it. Actually, the softer emission from the afterglow is doing probably the dust heating, if that is the mechanism.
All the people need it. You should have all sat up front. No.
Yeah, I just had a question about the lobe, which you saw, which actually is moving inward. I was wondering if you have an estimate for the velocity of that.
Oh, that's a good point. Let's see here. They were expecting not shock, but light crossing times of these knots, something like 4 months to cross a standard-sized knot. So that was a two-month separation between those two images where I thought it really was the same knot, and it moved. I'd have to say it probably moved maybe half of its width or something like that. It's consistent with C, just moving towards the remnant.
Okay, thank you, Tracy, and thanks also to all the speakers in this session. Okay, lunch, and we reconvene at 2:20.